Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Ambassador Rabbi David Saperstein, head of the World Union for Progressive Judaism. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. There is actual news this morning that has nothing to do with coronavirus, or at least very little. After a full year and more of inconclusive elections and failed negotiations, Israel finally has an official government. Bibi Netanyahu and Benny Gantz agreed last week to set up a national unity government, with Netanyahu serving as prime minister for 18 months, followed by a rotation to Gantz for the following 18 months. No matter where they fall on the political spectrum, Israelis must be sighing with relief that another fourth in a little over a year useless election has been avoided. This sort of rotation has been attempted before in national unity governments in Israel, sometimes in times of real national emergency, such as the current COVID-19 pandemic crisis, which has paralyzed the economies of the whole world. There was a national unity government in Israel in the period leading up to the Six-Day War in 1967, and others in 1984 and 2009. That last one led to Bibi Netanyahu becoming prime minister some 10 years ago, even though his Likud party did not have the largest representation in Knesset at the time. Typically, this rotation to the other party's leader as prime minister never happens. The guy in power will wait until conditions seem favorable for his party, and then he calls an early election and ends up with a narrower coalition that keeps him as prime minister. When you are dealing with a magician, or a slippery politician, depending on your point of view, like Netanyahu, that is the most likely outcome. On the other hand, if Bibi gets convicted of any of the criminal charges he is currently facing, Gantz will become prime minister sooner and keep the office. We will see. As part of this deal, Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, who has served as caretaker prime minister since December 2018, and really for 6 months, a while before that. Anyway, he'll remain prime minister for another year and a half, and then be replaced in October 2021, around the high holidays then, by blue and white Kachov Lavan leader Benny Gantz, who will serve as vice prime minister in the meantime. Netanyahu will then become vice prime minister under Gantz after that. But if he leaves the prime minister's office sooner, Gantz takes over. The Likud and its satellite parties will receive the finance, health, internal security, construction, transportation, and education portfolios. Kahol V'Lavan, blue and white, will receive the defense, foreign affairs, justice, economy, communications, and culture portfolios. The Knesset speaker will be from the Likud. The government is expected to have an unprecedented 36 ministers and 16 deputies, split equally between the center-right and the center-left. This very large number of positions in government was necessary in order to build a coalition that could get 60 votes, well, 61, I guess, and sustain the government. Besides Likud and Kahol Lavan, the government will include the following parties: Shas, United Torah Judaism, Labor, and the single Gesher member of Knesset, Orly Levi Abakasis. Now that is a weird coalition, ranging from the religious right to the pretty far left, but apparently it will hold, at least for a while. It's nice to know that in this current crisis, Israel finally has an official government. That Netanyahu remains in power should come as no surprise to anyone. We will see how it all ends up, but my bet is that Bibi escapes the corruption charges and stays in power, outmaneuvering Benny Gantz. But at least we won't have to have another election. And just in time for Yom HaAtzmaut, Israeli Independence Day this coming Tuesday, Israel finally has an official government. And so, to play us in this morning, here's Yisrael B'tach B'Hashem, Israel, trust in God, from the Psalms, A better choice than to trust in the Israeli political process, surely.
Israel, Israel, Israel.
That was Yisrael Betach Bashem, a Shlomo Karlbach melody to a psalm sung by Eitan Masuri, just in time for Yom HaAtzmaut this Monday night and Tuesday. We'll return in a moment on To Jewish. Our guest, Ambassador Rabbi David Saperstein, head of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, will explain how Reform congregations around the world are growing rapidly and where their challenges lie in diversifying Jewish synagogue life in Latin America, Eastern Europe, and elsewhere. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates an array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, cultural Jewish programming, and Jewish life cycle events. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times, and in these days of coronavirus tsoris, you can join us from anywhere on the globe. Every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. We'll hold our services with full music by virtual experiences weekly. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, which you can access just by emailing us at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Our synagogue at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance of the Foothills Mall. Not in the mall, but in the south side on our own building. Anyway, for now, we are a fully functioning virtual congregation on Zoom and Facebook. Email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, Beitsimcha, to get more information. For more about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, a religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses, conversion, all taught through Zoom, and, of course, all of our services on Facebook. You can also go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, beitsimchatucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Or BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish favorite guest, Ambassador Rabbi David Saperstein, who is the head of the World Union for Progressive Judaism. He's had a long career, I'm sorry to say that, a long career and a distinguished one with the Religious Action Center for the Reform Movement as the ambassador for the United States on human rights. Well, is that the correct term, religious rights?
Religious freedom.
Religious freedom. I'm working my way around to getting this right. And we're so pleased to have him back this morning. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Always good to be with you.
David, in taking over the World Union, obviously nobody saw this situation coming. How has the COVID-19 coronavirus crisis affected congregations around the world?
In very much the same way that it has affected congregations here in the United States. I was actually abroad in Australia on a two-week speaking tour as the crisis evolved into the serious crisis that has become. So in the beginning, on the night before Purim, when I first began my work there, everything was normal. Purim, that turned out, people weren't shaking hands. But other than that, people came. They were together in crowds. There was no 6 feet restriction. But very quickly, over the remaining time that I was there, it had moved to a point that they had stopped all gatherings, and the last 5 days of my speaking tour work and my meetings with religious and political leaders were all canceled. And I actually returned home on the last flight before the three-week moratorium on international flights took place. So all across the world, our synagogues have moved towards doing online religious services, online support efforts for the people in the congregation, coordinating online where congregations need help, delivery of food, doing shopping for others, leaving it at their front door. All of these efforts now are being done online. It's a revolutionary change in the way religious communities have functioned, and it will be interesting to see what the ongoing impact will be. Finally, I would point out, I think every nonprofit, every house of worship, every denomination, every religious social service agency is suffering from lack of funds. No one knows with the fall of the markets exactly where things are going, and this has created even more pressure on institutions. So as a quick overview, as I said, it's about the same as it is here, and it touches every single country across the globe.
We will talk much more on this subject and many others with Ambassador Rabbi David Saperstein. We return in a moment here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com, TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us as very popular Apple iTunes podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we started talking last week about the important passage in the Siddur, in the prayers, in the morning prayers, about Oseh Shalom Uvarea Ta'kol, God who makes, creates peace, or makes peace and creates everything. But the original source in Isaiah, in chapter 45, verse 7, is God who makes peace or makes good and creates evil, which is, you know, such a problematic passage when we're facing things like disease pandemics or natural disasters. It's one thing to say the Holocaust was caused by human beings and human beings make these choices and we choose evil sometimes. It's another thing to say, well, there's a disease and it's affected, and it doesn't have to be a pandemic, it could be cancer, something else. How do we reconcile that with our experience of God and thinking that God is good when God has created all of this, good and bad?
Well, it's not only that he...
Solve that for us all, would you please?
Right, right
no
away.
Pressure.
Yes, sir, right
immediately.
Away.
Immediately.
I think it's not only that he created the possibility for us to choose between good and bad, and for us to cultivate our Yetzer HaTov and minimize our Yetzer Hara, I think also clearly, if you read even just the book of Bereshit, book of Genesis, you see that God sometimes does bad things to the world. The flood, where he basically destroyed the whole world except for Noah and his family, and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Sodom and Gomorrah, right.
These were not like accidental happenings. And part of it is that we should learn to see God's hand in all things, I think. The things don't just happen. They happen for a reason. And that we also have to remember the non-Jewish definition of praying is to ask for something. It comes from the French or the Latin root, prière, to beg for something. Well, most of our prayers are not asking for things. They're exclaiming things.
Or they're praising God, or they're... or if there are bakashot, requests, they're always in the collective. God make peace in the world in a broad sense, not God help me win the lottery right. personally today.
But if you go through like the Birkot HaShachar, they're mostly, you know, blessed are you, Lord our God, who made me free, who clothes the naked, who feeds the hungry. It's praising in an almost exclamatory way, and recognizing the good. And so it seems only fair that we should also recognize the bad, and if God is the author of all things and all history, recognize that he is capable of inflicting great evil on the world, and it's either historically as a punishment or as a wake-up call.
Now, that doesn't mean any simplistic explanation for we have a plague because we were bad. Or actually, I was in the market one day, and all of the paper goods shelves were empty. And two women were walking towards me with a basket. And one of them said, God is angry because of this. That's why this is happening. And I thought hoarding did not cause the virus, even if terrible conduct is sometimes
right.
part of the package. We will maybe, I don't know if we're going to resolve this next week, but we'll continue to explore it. Thanks so much, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective. There are now two candidates for president of the United States, and neither one is Jewish, but both care very much about the Jewish vote in the November election. The majority of the Jewish vote has gone to the Democratic candidate in every election since 1920, exactly a century ago, when Warren Gamaliel Harding took 43% of the Jewish vote. The socialist Eugene Debs got 38% of the vote, and the Democrat Cox got just 19%. Harding actually took 60% of the national vote in that election, so Cox's dismal showing was as much because of Debs' success as anything the Republicans represented then. In the past 100 years, no Republican has come close to a majority of the Jewish vote. This year, we can expect nothing very much different in spite of Donald Trump's steadfast support of Israel and his Jewish daughter and son-in-law, who have a prominent place in his administration. In large part, this is because of the vile anti-Semitism of some of Trump's most vigorous supporters and his continued refusal to renounce them and their evil agenda. It is, frankly, difficult to understand the president's attitude towards the anti-Semites who vigorously campaigned for him, especially since he has shown no such anti-Semitic tendencies himself. It must be noted that President Trump is supported by people and organizations who have made reprehensible anti-Semitic statements and done truly awful things. Since Trump is opposed by former Vice President Joe Biden, who has a long record of pro-Israel votes and statements, and many close friends in the Jewish community, it seems very unlikely that the Jewish vote will go anything less than about 70% for the Democrat. That was our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie, an elderly Jewish lady, is leaving the garment district to go home from work. Suddenly, a man who's been walking towards her stands in front of her, blocks her path, opens up his raincoat, and flashes his wares in all their sordid glory. Unruffled, Sadie takes a long look and remarks, "This you call a lining?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature just for you. You should live and be well, and make sure you have a good lining. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portions of Achrimot Kedoshim, located near the midpoint of the book of Leviticus, Vayikra, while Kedoshim, with its holiness code rising to the great statement, "Love your neighbor as you love yourself," is a highlight of the whole Torah. Achrimot has much to teach, too. Leviticus is centered on the question of how to create holiness in our own lives, and Achrimot addresses the issue in a variety of ways. In particular, it includes all the biblical rituals related to the great and powerful Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, holiest day of the whole year for our ancestors, as it remains for us. We're commanded to afflict our souls that day, Ta'anu et nafshotechem. The rites described in Achrimot are quite detailed, and they form the basis for the ways in which our ancestors observed the Day of Atonement throughout the period when the temple stood in Jerusalem. The high priest purified himself completely. Then he offered sacrifices of atonement for himself, his family, and his people. He would then purify the holiest parts of the shrine of the temple and bring forward a goat as an atonement offering. The goat is one of the peculiarities of this ritual sequence. Actually, two goats are brought out. One, the scapegoat, this portion is the origin of that concept and term, is given the burden of symbolically carrying the sins of the people into the wilderness. The second goat is sacrificed as an atonement offering on the altar. Ultimately, after a day of self-denial and repentance, Ki vayom hazeh yechaper aleichem letaher etchem b'tchol chatotechem, on that day atonement shall be made for you to purify you from all your sins. It is through this process that we will be restored to holiness. It's notable that our ancestors recognized that our human societies, and organizations even, need to be able to transfer sins to another entity, literally a scapegoat, in order to feel that order and holiness are restored. That is, when things go wrong, we have to free ourselves from guilt by putting our hands on someone else and dumping our tzoras onto him or her. This has been the way of the world forever. What is notable in ancient Israelite society is that the fall guy is actually just a goat, not a person, and that the chosen dupe is simply sent out into the wilderness and not slaughtered. It is catharsis without real injury, a lesson we still haven't really learned, have we? We live in a society today and in a political climate in which blame and shame seem to be the two most powerful verbs at work, in which scapegoats are sought for every failure at every level of society, business, government, and religion, even for relationship failure. And blame and shame are then wildly publicized in every way. The Torah, which invented the concept, teaches a very different lesson. Accept the moral failure, reform any problematic conduct, but pass on the guilt to a nonverbal being and set it free. Then you can return to live a good and holy life. Not a bad lesson even today. When we return on Too Jewish, our guest, Ambassador Rabbi David Saperstein, will tell us how the progressive movement is growing and evolving as a dynamic force all around the world. Find out about it when we come back on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The man President Donald Trump just named to speak for the health department recently accused George Soros and the Rothschild family of seeking to exploit the coronavirus pandemic for world control and to advance their own agendas. Michael Caputo, who advised Trump's 2016 campaign, last week became spokesman for the Department of Health and Human Services, in part because of Trump's dissatisfaction with how Alex Azar, the department's secretary, was handling communications during the crisis. Caputo deleted tens of thousands of tweets just before the appointment. Some of these were released, nonetheless, to the press. On March 17th, responding to David Rothschild, a New York economist who is critical of Trump, Caputo said Rothschild is an inbred elitist sphincter whose family craves control. David Rothschild is not related to the European Rothschild family, which for centuries has been the target of anti-Semitic slander that it seeks world control. On March 15th, Caputo responded to a far-right figure, Jack Posobiec, who wondered on Twitter why George Soros, the liberal philanthropist, would give to his favored political causes but not to effort to combat coronavirus. In fact, George Soros has given tens of millions of dollars to coronavirus relief. Are you kidding? Caputo said. Soros's political agenda requires a pandemic. And then on March 27th, Caputo tweeted a photo of Soros captioned, "The real virus behind everything," and added skulls and crossbones. Soros has frequently been featured in vicious anti-Semitic attacks as a Jew seeking world control. And now President Trump has appointed a man as the official spokesman about coronavirus on behalf of the U.S. government, who has tweeted slanderous anti-Semitic lies about both Soros and the man who happens to be named Rothschild. Wonderful. The news that a Danish Lutheran group has rewritten the New Testament in order to omit the word Israel has been greeted by appropriate outrage, with critics calling it a surreal revision and a gift to Jew haters and Israel bashers. The Danish Bible Society's translation of the New Testament refrains from using the word Israel, instead substituting Jews and variations thereof, like land of the Jews for land of Israel. In other places, references to Israel were translated as referencing all readers or all of humanity. It's the first translation into Danish in more than 20 years. The words Jews and Israel both appear in the original text of the New Testament as separate and distinct words, of course. The translation group claimed the move was to avoid identifying ancient Israel with today's state of Israel, although other ancient names with modern equivalents, like Egypt and Syria, were not omitted. B'nai B'rith International reacted to the news, saying, "We are stunned that the new Danish Bible Society publication of the Bible erases references to Israel out of stated worry over confusion with the modern Jewish state." Yet this surreal revision causes confusion, and worse, whitewashing of history, identity, and sacred scripture. Rabbi Abraham Cooper, Associate Dean and Global Social Action Agenda Director at the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and a past guest of Too Jewish, said the Society's translation excluded that nasty six-letter word, I-S-R-A-E-L. Voila! No more Israel. Wow, will Jesus be surprised, he continued. Jew haters and Israel bashers rejoice. Jan Frost, a Bible enthusiast and supporter of Israel who is from Denmark, drew attention to the omissions on YouTube and other social media networks. The old theological expression for this is replacement theology, in which you replace Israel with the church, said Frost. Imam Tawhidi, a Muslim scholar who calls himself the Imam of Peace, said that the Danish Bible Society is driven by an agenda to present Jews as stateless. He also said the translation is false and against God. Kind of agree with him. The tendency among those protesting stay-at-home orders in America to call them Nazi orders and compare them to Gestapo techniques has spread throughout the far-right wing in America. In protests in Ohio against the shelter-in-place order, there were signs saying, "Jews are the real virus." And in Colorado, Governor Jared Polis became emotional during a news briefing about the coronavirus crisis in his state when a reporter said the public has compared his stay-at-home order to Nazism. "As a Jewish American who lost family in the Holocaust, I'm offended by any comparison to Nazism," said Polis during a briefing in Denver. "We act to save lives, the exact opposite of the slaughter of 6 million Jews and many Gypsies and Catholics and gays and lesbians and Russians and so many others." His voice cracked and tears welled up as he responded to the question. Polis, a Democrat elected in 2018, is Colorado's first Jewish governor, the first openly gay man ever elected governor of a state in America. "We're hearing a lot of reports around here," the reporter said. "And I know I've seen some stuff going on statewide about neighbors reporting on other neighbors for not following the orders. Seeing a lot of rebellion out here against your orders, which have been called tyrannical, against local health department orders, being equated to Nazism. How do you react to that? What do you say to these people who are clearly getting frustrated with this stay-at-home order?" Colorado House Minority Leader Patrick Neville also referred to Nazism during an interview to describe the stay-at-home orders. On March 25th, the day Polis issued the order, Neville, in an interview, said on a conservative radio program that orders like that lead to a Gestapo-like mentality. That kind of insane response has now become a standard part of extreme conservative rhetoric about coronavirus rules designed to protect the lives of Americans, including rules recommended by the president. While people like to see craziness on both sides of the political divide in America, it is clear that on the issue of protecting people from COVID-19, the craziness and the anti-Semitism are coming only from the extreme right. A Chabad emissary in Kathmandu will not be able to participate in Israel's marquee Independence Day ceremony after being ordered to withdraw by a Chabad rabbinical court. Chani Lifshitz said that she would not contest the rabbi's decision that will block her from the country's annual torchlighting ceremony on Yom HaAtzmaut. "I cannot enter the fire of discord," she said. In a letter dated April 17th and signed by the 7 members of the Israel-based court, the Chabad rabbis told Lifshitz to back out of the torchlighting, noting that she requires their permission to participate in any such ceremony. The letter gave no additional details, such as why they were preventing her from receiving this signal honor, which was being presented for her good work with Chabad. Each year, on the evening of Israel's Independence Day, 12 people who are especially outstanding for Israel and the Jewish people are chosen to light torches during the ceremony on Har Herzl, Mount Herzl. Being chosen is considered a great national honor. This year, because of restrictions due to coronavirus, the rite next Tuesday evening will be held remotely, but torchlighters were chosen as usual. Israel's Minister of Culture and Sport announced that Lifshitz, who has run the Chabad house in the Nepali capital with her husband, Chesky, for 20 years, would be one of the lighters. "She symbolizes the concern for others, warm hospitality, and love of the Jewish people that characterize the holy work of Chabad houses around the world," the minister said at the time. Now, as a result of the Chabad court's decision, Lifshitz is not participating. On a Facebook page she shares with her husband and also posted on the Chabad of Kathmandu Facebook page, Lifshitz said she would adhere to the decision of the rabbinical court. She also said she did not need the ceremony to feel good about her work. "Maybe I won't hold a torch in my hands, but I already have received the greatest honor in this world, a life of purpose and mutual assistance," she wrote. "There is no greater gift than this." Unlike most Hasidic and other Haredi Jews in Israel, Chabad adherents serve in the army and vote in national elections, making them more embedded in mainstream society. What's more, Chabad centers throughout the world host and assist Israelis during their pre- and post-army treks. Thousands of Israeli backpackers visit the Chabad in Kathmandu every year, including for a Pesach Seder that is likely the largest in the world. This year, of course, that Seder could not take place. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Ambassador Rabbi David Saperstein. He's the head of the World Union for Progressive Judaism. He He was the ambassador for the United States on religious rights around the world, religious freedom. He served for a long time and a very distinguished career at the Religious Action Center, making it a kind of a center for deep commitment to religious change on the political forum. David, you took over the World Union last year from Danny Freelander. Tell me what the issues facing the progressive movement around the world are right now.
Well, it's been a period of enormous growth across the globe. The Reform Jewish movement, or very often on the international scene called the Progressive Jewish movement, is now found in 50 countries across the globe, including many countries and many communities within those countries where one never would have expected to see this growth. So, for example, in the former Soviet Union, because of decades and generations of secularism, post-secularism in the society, a more modern expression of Judaism, combining contemporary rational aesthetics with Jewish tradition and Jewish ceremonies, ritual, and study, has been very appealing to, particularly to people of the younger generation. So we get significant interest and turnout and engagement of people in our communities in the FSU. Of course, they don't have the resources to build the kind of institutions that help, and they're puts an enormous strain on the World Union for Progressive Judaism, and thankfully many individual donors and federations here in the United States, Jewish federations, are helping to support our institutions there, but it is a constant effort to raise the funds needed. And across the globe, we, it's extraordinary to see what's happening in the last high holidays. We place visiting rabbis, as we do in the emerging communities and smaller communities, for Passover and for the high holidays, if not more frequently. But we place for the high holidays rabbis in Beijing, in Bangkok, in Burma, in Belarus, in Brazil, in Barcelona, in Bali. And that's only the bees.
Only the bees, right?
Here. So, it's a period of enormous growth. And by the way, the same is true in Israel as well, of very substantial growth in the non-Orthodox movements in the last decade.
So I'm not sure that our listeners necessarily understand. In America, there's a perception that the vast majority of Jews are non-Orthodox, are affiliated, or interested in or declare themselves to be Reform or perhaps conservative or some other variation. That's not the way it usually is presented outside the United States.
No, you're absolutely right that this is an anomaly in North America, and particularly in the United States, where the Reform Jewish movement has been on the American religious scene the only really vibrantly growing theologically liberal denomination over the last 60 years. When I was growing up, the conservative Jewish movement was the largest stream of the Jewish community. Today, according to the Pew poll, reaffirmed by the recent American Jewish Committee poll, the Reform movement is larger than the Orthodox, conservative, Reconstructionist movements combined. So this is a very different pattern that we have here. In almost every other country, the Orthodox community is the largest segment of the community, and it's a constant struggle for conservative, Masorti, and Reform, progressive synagogues to have a place at the table, to be able to get funding from government funding or institutional funding that funds the Jewish community, and that remains a constant challenge for us. There are some countries, Germany is an example, in which we've made significant progress having a place representative of our numbers at the table of the broader Jewish institutions. There are other countries in which the Orthodox community really is resistant to that, and we have to find ways around them, to funding sources, to connections with the government, to outreach to the potentially much larger Jewish public that often is not yet involved in any stream of Judaism.
The without getting too political, certainly in some countries there are close political ties between some of the Orthodox representatives. Sometimes it's Chabad, sometimes it's others. They don't always welcome the participation of Reform progressive congregations, do they?
No, as I was saying, we often have to work around them for that reason, or really organize and mobilize to insist that we have a place at the table that is proportionate to our numbers in the community. And it is, very often when governments in many other countries, as opposed to the United States, government fund religious institutions, and the money goes through some umbrella group, the Catholic bishops in the Catholic community, the National Council of Churches of that country, and the Protestant community. For the Jewish community, it's often some kind of board of deputies of the Jewish community. And in those countries, Great Britain, Germany, other countries where we have a role at the table, we get a fair share of support. In many countries where the Orthodox dominate, we don't. And it is a real challenge in terms of growing the movement. And we're seeing the same thing, as I said, in Israel. Here, our campaign to have the Israeli government treat all of the streams of the Jewish community with equal respect and equal rights has been a hallmark of one of Israel's great failures and one of the non-Orthodox community's great efforts that are finally taking hold and making a difference in Israel.
Is there a difficulty in finding rabbis who speak the native language? Not so much in Israel now, but it seems to me that might be the greatest challenge at times for the world.
That's a very knowledgeable question. Sam, what happens very often is, young people, we have very strong equivalents to NIFTY, the National Federation, and North American Federation of Temple Youth. Here in North America, the equivalent to NIFTY across the globe is called Netzer Olami. It is robust in so many of the countries, the 50 countries across the globe. Even before there are congregations or very effective congregations, we'll have a strong Netzer or our young adult arm, Tamar, movement growing there. And many of these young people get inspired to devote their lives to Jewish service, become Jewish educators, Jewish professionals, and a number of them want to become rabbis. And when they do, they end up traveling to the United States to study at the Hebrew Union College, or to Israel to study at the Hebrew Union College branch in Jerusalem, or they go to Germany to study at Gaga College, or to London to study at the Leo Beck College. And many of them, very quickly, be serving a congregation as part of their rabbinic training here, and they end up creating ties, falling in love, marrying someone, and they don't come home, despite right. what their intentions were in the beginning. More and more, we find efforts to actually train people in their native language. So in Russia now, we have a robust institute going to be graduating its first class that works, spend either time in Israel or at the Geiger College in Germany. But they are studying at the institute in Moscow in their native language. We now have an instituto in Buenos Aires that is training people online with a very good faculty, both in Portuguese and in Spanish, rabbis. And that's also having an impact as well. A new entity is developing now in France, because with Brexit, it's harder for them to go to the Leo Beck College to study. So it is, we're seeing an effort to really train people in their native language, which hopefully will have more and more of them remaining in the countries that they grew up in the native language they speak in. And it seems to be working, and it looks like it's going to have a major impact in shaping the next generation of the progressive Jewish community globally.
So just to give a sense of proportion, how many rabbis do you think will be produced, say, in the next 5 years in the former Soviet Union in Russia, for Russia?
I don't know the answer to that, but I would guess in the, and if you're talking about the next 5 years, I would say in the 30 to 40 range. And just imagine, I mean, that's more rabbis than we have congregations now. And there are a lot of emerging communities that if they had a rabbi would develop into congregations. Right now, we probably have 15 rabbis in the former Soviet Union. What a difference this could make if even half the number, I'm guessing, even if 15 are produced in this in the next 5 years, what a difference it will be. But I think the number I gave you, counting those still in school and those who have been ordained, is an accurate number for the next 5 years.
So a kind of odd question. When I went through Hebrew Union College, and I'm sure it wasn't terribly different back when you went through Hebrew Union College, there were zero classes in fundraising or development. it seems to me that in today's nonprofit world, that's an essential for rabbis, particularly serving in World Union congregations. Is there some attempt to rectify that, shall we say, lacuna in our education?
For your listeners, here, let's just set the context. Of this, every seminary and every faith group, including in the Jewish community, including in the Reform Jewish community, every seminary faces a dilemma. Is this an academic institution providing an academic degree? Is this a professional institution training people for a life of service in the communities that they will serve? And what is the balance in our program that strikes the best balance here? So the Hebrew Union College trains people in all of our seminaries, trains people in practical rabbinics, and it trains people in deep academic study of Jewish studies. There is a balance, homiletics classes, how to give a sermon, how to give a eulogy, how education classes, how to be an effective teacher here, and also increasingly compared to, I think, when you and I went to school, some focus on administrative skills that are necessary. A number of our students take joint degrees now in social service, in administration, in education, along with their rabbinic degree in ordination. So, there's a kind of patchwork quilt of different approaches and different balances, even in, I think in different schools within Hebrew Union College, there would be slightly different emphases. We do a better job than we did before, but fundraising, you know, still is one of those things that handled usually in a class or two. We found this in the social justice realm at the Religious Action Center. We used to spend a lot of effort training rabbis in rabbinic school, and we still do some of that. And we realized by the time they were actually out where they reached the point they needed those skills, they had forgotten a lot of what they learned in the class. So we now do much more in the field training of rabbis who are out in the field, who we go through, bring through an intensive year and a half study program, some online, some in person, to help them sharpen their social justice organizing skills and programming skills, et cetera. And the same happens in other aspects of practical rabbinics.
Where do you see the greatest potential out of all of the different regions? You know, the World Union spans literally the world. I suppose there aren't any Reform congregations at Antarctica, but pretty much every other continent.
No institutions of any kind like that in Antarctica.
No, I'm afraid not.
Well, then, Jewish community.
With enough global warming, who knows? There may
be. Touche. Sadly, that may be more than a joke.
Yeah, unfortunately.
We have throughout Asia, we now have communities where we didn't. You know, 10 years ago, there was virtually nothing, a handful. Now there are a number of them. Certainly in the former Soviet Union, for the reasons I explained, Reform Judaism has taken hold there. And if we're able to train these rabbis who are now running through our program and sustain that over the next 5 years, it will be a very different landscape for us. here in some countries, Belarus and others, very good relations between our communities and our leaders and the government officials who were often the key interlocutor for the broader Jewish community. So we, you know, we see great opportunity there. Obviously, we're now the non-Orthodox streams in Israel now reach 13% of the population identifies with the non-Orthodox streams, which is exactly the same number of Haredi Jews in Israel.
Wow.
And we've doubled our size, doubled our congregations and institutions in the last 15 years. So here again, we're growing substantially and making gains in terms of getting support from Zionist institutions and from the government. So because we win cases in the Supreme Court that forces the government to provide more equal support to the different streams proportionate to our numbers. So there are a number of areas of great growth. I think with the Instituto, we'll see in Brazil and Argentina even more growth once the economic problems that those countries face, over and above those that the globe faces, begin to improve. So, these are the areas that we're looking for and investing in and hope to see more and more Reformed Jews so that one day, the kind of progressive option that is represented by the Reform movement in the United States, the success of which just so impresses and bewilders Jews in countries across the globe. When I am giving speeches there, they can't conceive about the extraordinary success in North America that the liberal streams have had. I hope that that will become a global phenomenon.
I want to thank Ambassador Rabbi David Saperstein for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the World Union?
Well, you know, our website at the World Union for Progressive Judaism, www.wupj.org, will have almost everything that you want to learn about the World Union, and you'll see all the resources that are produced to support our congregations across the globe.
And of course, as soon as anybody's ever able to travel again, a great place to find congregations wherever you're going.
David. Oh, we have a wonderful app called Find a Community, so that any of you who are traveling, who want to visit on Shabbat, the Reform Synagogue, to see what Jewish programs are being provided in the community you're visiting, you can easily find it, and it will help guide you to these congregations.
Thanks so much. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Two Jewish will be Gail Carson Levine, the author of the book Ella Enchanted, on her new book, A Ceiling Made of Eggshells. Our playout this morning comes from a young singer, Uziah Tzadok, singing Keshalev Bocheh, When the Heart Cries, on the Israeli Star is Born show. My friends, may you have a healthy week. God willing, a Shavua Tov and a week we pray of peace. רק אלוקים שומע, הכאב עולה מתוך הנשמה. אדם נופל לפני שהוא שוקע, בתפילה קטנה חותך את הדממה. שמע ישראל אלוקי, אתה כל יכול. נתת לי את חיי, נתת לי הכל. בעיניי דמעה, הלב בוכה בשקט. וכשהלב שותק, הנשמה זועקת.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.